This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for February 2014. I'm Don Scher, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Lindsay Garbutt, assistant editor for the magazine. On the podcast this month, you'll hear readings from Ocean Vuong.
As footsteps fill the square like stones fallen from the sky.
And from Mattia Harvey.
My tail split in two, sprouted knees and feet, toes.
We can only record a few poets for the podcast each month. But Don, what else is in this issue?
We are lucky enough to have some of Larry Leavis's final poems. He was a very important and popular poet, as many of our listeners and readers will remember. And a lot of his work has been emerging over the past few years. So we're lucky to have those. We have some new poems from Jamal May. And also something that's kind of interesting, I think, in terms of the process of composition, is Casey Muhammad's sonograms. And you'll have to look at the issue to see what his process is about. But basically, he feeds Shakespeare sonnets into an internet anagram machine, and he moves the letters around and clicks and drags on things to come up with these sonnets that are derived from Shakespeare. But they're sort of clever and funny the way he is in real life.
We also have a long essay in this issue by Mark Ford on Joan Murray, who was the first poet that Auden chose for the Yale Younger Poets series. She was actually already deceased at the time that he chose her. So it's a very interesting essay about several of her poems and also the reason why Auden chose her.
We're joined once again this month by our consulting editor, Christina Pugh. Christina, can you pick a poem in the issue to read and talk about a bit?
Absolutely. I would like to choose Nance Van Winkle's poem, Been About. Nance Van Winkle's a poet as well as a fiction writer. And I chose this poem because I loved the way that it hides itself from us. It hides its identity as a love poem, much the way the speaker is hiding in the barn from the person who turns out to be the lover. Been About. The rat traps emptied, the grain troughs filled. The distance between sheep shed and my own ice melt dripping on the mat equals the diameter of moonlight squared on his face as he looks up and finds me again. Says he's sure I'd been swallowed by the elements, says he'd been about to come looking. I step into the warm, two bas from out back where I'd worked. Two tufts of wool he lifts from my hair. In just such a manner are sleek blue words slyly acquired by a wispy, whiter-than-snow page. He's seen it happen, seen a tear of mine, then two, well up and slip loose as the little boat of orgasm veers into the vortex.
Well, it's one of those poems where each line pushes you along to the next. There's nothing predictable about it.
At first, it seems like this is a poem about doing agricultural work. and then it really reveals itself as this very moving love poem when we're told that this man has seen a tear of mine then too well up and slip loose as the little boat of orgasm veers into the vortex. And that is something so powerful, even more so because it hasn't really been fully prepared for in a certain way. It really works as a wonderful surprise.
Mm-hmm. The sense of it does feel familiar because you do realize it's a love poem and you do get the sort of agricultural setting. And in a way, it sort of harkens back a little bit maybe to, Ovid or something. There's transformations and, you know, things are sort of changing. There's some sense of the connection between like the landscape of work and love and life, you know, that these things are not so separate as they tend to be.
Yeah, the interesting and strange part of this poem to me is where it takes a turn towards the end where she says, in just such a manner are sleek blue words slyly acquired by a wispy, whiter-than-snow page. Mm. That's such an imaginative area of the poem, I feel, in contrast to the realness that starts it off at the beginning. And I feel like it could almost be a pitfall to say whiter-than-snow page. Mm. But because of that ice melt in the beginning, you can almost believe it in a way that I wouldn't have normally expected.
Well, the poem illuminates itself. You know, you've got the moonlight and tufts of wool have a kind of, I'm just imagining this. Mm-hmm. I assume they're sort of white or mm-hmm. moonlight yeah. tinged by earthiness in those tufts of wool from those sheep. And then the whiter than snow page, of course, is sort of a narrative progression there, but it's got a backbone to it mm-hmm. that supports mm-hmm. the poem. And yet there's something sort of delicate about it.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful spot to look at as well. And there's that hinge, too, with he's seen it happen, seen a tear of mine then to well up and slip loose. It seems to be referring to just those lines that Lindsay was just talking about. In just such a manner are sleek blue words slyly acquired by a wispy whiter than snow page. He's seen it happen, seen a tear of mine. There's this kind of wonderful latticing between the page and the tear, which is also connected to the ice melt dripping on mm-hmm. the mat in the work with the sheep in the sheep shed.
This is the first time Ocean Vuong has appeared in poetry. His book Burnings came out in 2010, and last year he won a Pushcart Prize.
We have two of his poems in the February issue. The first one we're going to hear is called Detonation. Ocean Vuong told us that the poem got its start from a letter he tried to write to his father, whom he hadn't seen for quite some time.
It took me a long time staring at this blank page. The whiteness of the page was almost suffocating. And I finally just kept writing the word father. But I wrote it in Vietnamese, and I kept on writing ba, 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 ba. And I thought thinking about what that word means to me and how it's always related to Vietnam and Vietnam's history and my tether to that history. And I kept seeing this bright page as a lit bomb. And I was just trying to carve him out of that.
It's worth pointing out that the N in detonation is capitalized. So at first glance, it reads like detonation.
Detonation. There's a joke that ends with, huh? It's the bomb saying, here's your father. Now here is your father inside your lungs. Look how lighter the earth is. Afterward, to even write the word father is to carve a portion of the day out of a bomb bright page. There's enough light to drown in, but never enough to enter the bones and stay. Don't stay here, he said. My boy, broken by the names of flowers. Don't cry anymore. So I ran into the night, my shadow growing toward my father.
That's very lovely. The first line all by itself is a line you become accustomed to seeing, I think, in a lot of poems.
There's a joke that
There's
ends
a joke
with,
that ends with, huh? Mm-hmm. And then you immediately are given to understand that there is no joke as such in the poem. Not to be too glib, but it's sort of more huh than joke. And it's funny, you know, when I put the issue together, I didn't do this on purpose, but I realize as we're talking about it, that there's a similar illumination in this poem, I mean, the whiteness or light of the page mm-hmm. that Hest is obliged to reflect and contain reflections on a real life and a real relationship. And here, the detonation of bombs is a kind of illumination that isn't wisdom. It's a kind of flash that can be very destructive. So this seems very poignant to me in many, many ways.
Yeah, that carving seems very poignant. He speaks about it in his words about the poem, and also that effortful quality to write in English.
To even write the word father is to carve a portion of the day out of a bomb bright page.
The work on the page is connected to a particular, in this case, historically horrific setting.
Yeah. I mean, I think that relates to the title of this poem, the way he capitalized the N in detonation so that you notice the nation in there.
Mm-hmm.
His sense of belonging is wrapped up in this detonation. And I also really love the ending of this poem.
So I ran into the night. The night, my shadow growing toward my father.
So as he's running away, there's a part of him that is still connected to that past, mm-hmm. and even lengthening that connection.
Well, and it moves from the light to the darkness without pathology, you know, mm-hmm. that it's a way of making a relationship. In the lines before the ones you quoted, it's really sort of stunning to me.
Don't stay here, he said. My boy, broken by the names of flowers. Don't cry anymore.
That's a hard thing I would have to believe for a father to say to a son and for a son to hear. But I like how it's preserved in the poem, that difficulty, the sort of explosiveness of the relationship is sort of recast into shadows moving towards each mm-hmm. other, mm-hmm. which redeems that darkness.
Let's hear another poem by Ocean Vuong. This one, Obad with Burning City.
The Burning City is Saigon at the end of the Vietnam War.
My grandmother was alive during the fall of Saigon. She was actually in Saigon. And she kept on saying, the city fell to the snow song. I always heard that as a child. And it wasn't until much later that I researched and found that it was Erlen Berlin's White Christmas.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
Saigon fell in April of 1975, and as Vuong explains in an epigraph to this poem, Armed Forces Radio played the song as a code to begin Operation Frequent Wind, the ultimate evacuation of American civilians and Vietnamese refugees by helicopter.
Growing up, I kept on imagining my grandmother in this chaos beneath a blizzard or in the middle of a blizzard. I kept on imagining Vietnam covered in snow. It was a very bizarre, surreal image. And I think this poem was my way of trying to express that.
Here's Obad with Burning City.
Milk flower petals on the street, like pieces of a girl's dress. May your days be merry and bright. He fills a teacup with champagne, brings it to her lips. Open, he says. She opens. Outside, a soldier spits out his cigarette as footsteps fill the square like stones fallen from the sky. May all your Christmases be white as the traffic guard unstraps his holster, his hand running the hem of her white dress, his black eyes, her black hair, a single candle, their shadows, two wicks. A military truck speeds through the intersection, the sound of children shrieking inside, a bicycle hurled through a store window. When the dust rises, a black dog lies in the road, panting, its hind legs crushed into the shine of a white Christmas. On the nightstand, a sprig of magnolia expands like a secret heard for the first time. The treetops glisten, and children listen. The chief of police face down in a pool of Coca-Cola, a palm-sized photo of his father soaking beside his left ear. The song moving through the city like a widow, a white, I'm dreaming of a curtain of snow falling from her shoulders. Snow crackling against the window. Snow shredded with gunfire, red sky, snow on the tanks rolling over the city walls, a helicopter lifting the living just out of reach, the city so white it is ready for ink. The radio saying run, run, run. Milk flower petals on a black dock, like pieces of a girl's dress. May your days be merry and bright. She is saying something neither of them can hear. The hotel rocks beneath them, the bed a field of ice cracking. Don't worry, he says, as the first bomb brightens their faces. My brothers have won the war, and tomorrow the lights go out. I'm dreaming to hear sleigh bells in the snow. In the square below, a nun on fire runs silently toward her God. Open, he says. She opens.
One of the most remarkable things to me about this poem on first reading it was the use of color in it. Obviously, with the repetition of white Christmas, you're going to get that white color over and over with the snow. But there's also an emphasis on black eyes, black hair, black dog, sprigs of magnolia and milk flower, which are white. And even when the chief of police is face down, he's in a pool of Coca-Cola, which is dark. It's not red. And so the only instance of color explicitly mentioned in the poem is red sky, which is almost exactly in the middle of the poem.
Snow shredded with gunfire. Red sky, snow on the tanks rolling over the city walls.
Well, obviously, too, there's something so bizarre and maybe, you know, cynical about this choice of white Christmas as a code to begin the evacuation in April. As the cliche goes, you couldn't make this stuff up. But so for the poet, the question is what to be made of it. And I think it is a very intense and deftly done performance, I guess, because you can hear that song and you can see these characters panicking. You can see everything sort of escaping from them. In some cases, their lives. And then there's the real escape of people who are able to get out.
A helicopter lifting the living just out of reach, the city so white it is ready for ink.
That's such a stunning line because that event has become ink. I mean, literally, this poem, the history written about it, starting with news reports of the time all the way to the current moment.
In the square below, a nun on fire runs silently toward her God. Open, he says.
It's a little bit of a stretch, I know, but that's kind of out of Hopkins in a way, or at least it's the same kind of thing that the terror actually resolves into something else completely unworldly. It's hard to believe that a poet can reach that moment, given all the extremity there. And so Hopkins pulls it off, and I think in this poem, Ocean Vuong pulls that off. It's amazing.
Do you also hear a little bit of pound in here, too?
Milk flower petals on a black dock.
Yeah.
You know, and one thing I liked about that was that milk flower petals on the street like pieces of a girl's dress, if it occurred on its own in a poem, might be a very, shall we say, benignly lyrical moment. A metaphor is a metaphor. And after everything that's happened in the poem, pieces of a girl's dress are concretized, literalized. Yeah. That milk flower petals on a black dog seems to have this really interesting echo of pounds in a station of the metro. You know, the apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough.
It's interesting that you mention that because what both those poems do, I mean, that pound poem. It's sort of famous for having been cut down to the couple of lines that it is from a longer poem. And this is sort of the imagist moment where movement, because in Pound's poem, it's people moving, you know, they're moving around, but it's sort of captured in this sort of image, is sort of flash frozen into that, yet the movement is there and the wetness of the bough always feels fresh. And as it's kind of transformed in, or you could say embedded in this poem, that technique is still the same thing. So that we've all, or I imagine most of us have seen that footage of people running around and climbing up in the buildings with the helicopters and people trying to, you know, it's all motion. Mm-hmm. It's the panic of motion that stays with us. And in the poem, that movement is everywhere. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, it's sort of captured, it's sort of expressed in its essence, the essence of the colors and the sounds and this music playing and the, you know, the violence of it and all. It sort of takes from Pound that ability to eternalize a moment. But here it's not just sort of art for art's sake.
Absolutely
or an
not.
Aesthetic program or a political program. It's a series of human moments that cannot be forgotten.
Once upon a time, in the time of once upon a time, there was a mermaid who loved sound and light.
Well, now for something completely different. In the February issue, we have a portfolio featuring a work by Mattia Harvey called Teletrofono. It's going to take a couple minutes to explain what it is. Poetry, radio drama, audio tour. We asked Mattia Harvey to explain it.
The way that I write things, they usually come out as poems. And I suppose it is sort of a drama too. And then later, I started illustrating it with these embroidered handkerchiefs. So I don't really tend to classify things too much. I'm fine with them being sort of whatever the person perceives them as.
Teletrofono got its start when the Guggenheim Museum asked sound artist Justin Bennett to do an audio piece on Staten Island. Justin asked Mattia Harvey to collaborate with him on it. They eventually hit on the idea of doing a site-specific sound walk featuring a former Staten Island resident, Antonio Meucci.
Antonio Meucci is he was many, many things. He was basically an inventor. He started out working in a theater in Florence where he met his wife, Estera. And there he was a lighting and sound designer, but he had a million other careers and patents. So in 1830, I believe, he and his wife moved to Cuba. And in 1850, they moved to Staten Island.
Meucci is celebrated in Italy for inventing the telephone, or teletrofono, as he called it, before Alexander Graham Bell. In Mattia Harvey's telling, the facts of Meucci's life mingle with the fantastic. For instance,
there's a rather important element, which is that I decided that Estera Meucci was a mermaid.
We're going to hear one of the monologues from that mermaid, Estera. We asked Mattia Harvey to introduce it.
The story of the Little Mermaid has always kind of bothered me because she basically sacrifices everything for love and then doesn't even get the man in the end. So I didn't want Estera to come onto land for love, but because she loves the sound of things. And I think that was because it was a sound piece and because walking around Staten Island with Justin and his microphones made me incredibly aware of all the sounds that were going on. And so it was very easy to imagine this mermaid who didn't really get to hear what she wanted to hear underwater, and when she came out of the water, could hear what she wanted to hear.
Here's Mattia Harvey from an excerpt of Justin Bennett's audio production of Teletrofono.
Humans, let me tell you something. Mermaids, sirens, shipwreckers, whatever you call us on a particular day, we don't abandon the sea for love or legs. We fling ourselves onto the shore for sound. I mooned around for years, waiting for the carp's accordion gills to wheeze out a tune, for a deafening chorus from those wide-mouthed anemones. Monday was muffled, Tuesday mute. Until Sunday, I smashed my head through the barrier between sea and sky, and there was the 2-ton wave timpani.
dolphin's claws click, click, clicking as it skidded to a stop on the cliff's edge, rain spanking the sea until it wailed. I clapped my hands, and the claps echoed back like an answer. Yes. 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 Between the third and fourth yes, my tail split in two. Sprouted knees and feet. Toes.
I have to say the story of the Little Mermaid has always bothered me too when I was a little kid. It's just sort of the amazing recasting of this story is just one of the many peculiar splendors of this piece. There's something of Stevens in this, although the texture of it isn't like Stevens at all because it's not so tightly controlled. But there's this idea that there's this whole other realm of the imagination that pushes back against the reality. So this longer piece, you know, it's got all these patents for Meucci's inventions and all this sort of documentary material that is sort of stitched together into something that creates this weird alternative world. But it's very vivid. Mm-hmm. I mean, it feels like you're there. When you're reading it, you sort of get taken to these strange places that the poet has come up with out of this unusual material.
Yeah, it's funny. The first time I read it, I didn't even think of The Little Mermaid, which sounds incredible. But the world that she's created in this piece is so detailed and thorough that it just stands on its own, I think. It almost feels like a period piece. It's so richly decorated because they work in an opera house and there's all these beautiful costumes that Estera works on.
This seems like a very empowered mermaid right at this moment, saying yes, 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 like Molly Bloom. And, you know, when you think about the Anderson Little Mermaid, poor thing, you know, she has to lose her tongue and get it cut out, you know, in order
really
to
become,
it is, it's terrible. And so it's like a recuperation of mermaid as powerful force rather than someone at the mercy of a witch or a prince, somebody following her own desires for sound.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear another excerpt from Teletrofono.
This is Antonio Meucci describing the first time that he meets his wife Estera, or his future wife Estera. And in it, he's hearing her before he sees her. And she's become a costume designer at the theater where they both work, and she's putting little elements of sound into all of her costumes.
Meucci is played in the audio production by Stefano Gulizia.
I heard her before I saw her. The costumes she designed were all about sound. The whisper, swish, catch of gauze against raw satin. Corsets ringed with tiny bells. Shoes with metal plates on the toes and suede on the heels, clack shuffling across the stage. She must have seen me listening, because a few nights later, when I put my ear to the speaking tube, I'd made for the director to talk to the stagehands perched in the trellises. There was only one word waiting. Meucci, 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 over and over, Meucci, as if she were calling Meucci for a pet. Cat, followed by a giggle Meucci that sounded like Meucci water running down Meucci steps of glass.
Meucci. Meucci.
I think what's sort of compelling about it for me overall as a sort of large project is this idea of meticulous invention, you know, especially when you think of these old patents, you know, and people inventing little machines to do strange things we don't need done. And then some of them are great inventions like a telephone that we take for granted. And then all that sort of process of people trying to come up with stuff, and some of it works and some of it's sort of grandly useless, even if attractive. It works for me because that's how poetry is. That some of the grandest schemes and inventions of poetry, you know, we talked about Pound a little bit early in the cantos. To me, that's like, you know, he patented all of these poetry moves we take for granted. And some of them, you know, like imagism, are brilliant and sort of everlasting. And then some of them, like the structure of the cantos itself, it's just like, did that one work out okay? What do we do with that invention? It's hard to say. So that connection that Mitya Harvey makes between the sort of clunky and insanely ingenious capability of inventors is kind of what poetry and people reading poetry have to contend with all the time. And what is this invention? What's it for? Does it work? Is it interesting? Is it crazy? Is it some combination of those things? And the cumulative effect is a kind of eerie sensation. Christina Pugh, thanks once again for coming onto the podcast. You can read Teletrafono and find out what happens to Meucci and Estera in the February 2014 issue of Poetry Magazine.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Lindsay Garbett.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.